So one of the problems that we're facing in our communities now, and this is one of the problems that kind of came out of the second book and me trying to understand, how do we first of all hold our leaders accountable to an authentic indigenous existence perspective, framework of viewing the world, worldview, whatever you want to call it. And if it's a problem for our leaders, then it's a problem for us as well. And we have to really think about, is it the right time in our history, and what are the problems with focusing on large-scale land claims and government jurisdictional solutions when the foundation of our existence has been weakened to such a point where it's threatening our very indigeneity, our being indigenous. And so it seems like at this point, doing land claims, doing self-government, without first putting the work into the strengthening of our existence as people, as individuals, as families, as clans, as nations, doing those big, large-scale political projects seems to be almost counterproductive to the survival of our people in the long term. Because one of the things that I realized after speaking to so many people who had been rooted in traditional understandings all their lives is that, and it's not that it was told to me, it's just that you can see it in the people that you're talking to and the kind of lives that they lead, is that what we call traditional government, or the ideal that we have of the restoration of our nations and our society's long traditional values, that was founded on the existence of a multitude of very strong people. So it wasn't a government that created the happiness and the good social relationships that our people enjoyed. It was strong people carrying the teachings, the understandings, the healthy ways of living, all of these things inside them that created the government. It sounds kind of, basic and obvious, but think about the way that our politics is constructed. We have identified a problem. I mean, at the risk of overly simplifying things, we're all academics here, so we're all used to theory and simplifying things for the sake of understanding and conveying a point. We're colonized. That's the problem. We're colonized. What does that mean? Well, we're disconnected from the sources of our strength and our happiness. That's one way of thinking about it. And we need to recover that. We need to recover strength and happiness. I mean, I don't know if it can get boiled down to a more basic point than that, what colonization is and what decolonization is. We're trying to recover a healthy life that leads to human happiness. And that's what every human being is seeking. But in our context, in our history, and in our place in the world right now, our struggle is to free ourselves from all of the sources of our discontent and unhealthy existence and the denial of our rights. Okay? And how are we trying to do that? And here's the problem that I've just been speaking about for the last little while. We're trying to do that by pursuing decolonization or freedom in ways that I believe have no hope of accomplishing the original objective, but yet form the thrust of all of our political life and to a large extent our cultural life at this point, and even informing the way we live amongst ourselves socially. So for example, we're pursuing decolonization in ways that draw from the framework of the problem that we're trying to escape from. So it was Einstein there. A lot of people said it throughout history, but Einstein, I think, said it. You can't solve a problem from within the framework it was created. That doesn't seem to have sunk in for our people. We're trying to create decolonization using constitutional law. We're trying to create decolonization using violence. We're trying to create decolonization using money. Now, if you think about it, another law of the world basically is this consistency, and always consistency, between the means and the ends that you use. The means that you use to advance an objective are going to basically generate the ends that you get from it. So think about that law, that rule, or that assertion, whatever you want to think about it, in the context of what I was just talking about in the past, that indigenous peoples have used to try to free themselves from this problem that we've defined ourselves as existing within. We've taken from the colonial discourse, let's start with violence. Not not to say our people have used violence, but I'm speaking about indigenous peoples generally here. And there's lots of revolutionary movements in South and Latin America that have pursued and developed philosophies and ideologies based on violent revolution. Excuse me, I have a bit of a cold there. Now, if we think about that, follow the logic through. Violence is the thing that has oppressed us. Therefore, what we need to do is advance a movement to meet violence with violence. We need to protect ourselves. We need to meet force with force. We need to pursue the defeat of the state. Thank you. We need to pursue the defeat of the state. And we have all kinds of movements. I mean, emblematic of those movements, although it wasn't specifically an indigenous movement, but it was for poor people in Latin America. And the emblem, Che Guevara, and the revolutionaries in Latin America has a great hold on the younger generation of indigenous revolutionaries here in North America, I can say. But let's just take that as an example. You pursue that, and it has been pursued in Latin America by indigenous peoples as a path of freedom. And there's an extensive literature, and I'm sure everybody knows about the experience of Latin American peoples in confronting imperialism through armed revolution. And that's not to say that it's not logical. Yeah, and saying what I'm going to be saying, I'm not saying it's not logical or that it's not rational. In fact, it's very rational if you think about it. You can create rationalities for just about anything, but you have to think again about where it leads us. Now think about all of the cases where people have tried to overcome imperialism or their domination or decolonize by using that path. And all it's done is create societies, situations, where violence is the defining feature. Because they've used violence as the means to create the society, inherently it's going to be a violent society. And my argument in this book, and I only have a little bit of time here, so I'm trying to condense everything. My argument in this book is that if we want to remain consistent to the fundamental teachings from within our own traditions and the fundamental values that we've collectively defined that shape the objectives of our people as Ungwehunwe, as indigenous people, none of those values mention wanting to have a violent society governed by a totalitarian government at the end. So whether it's Vietnam, China, Cuba, or any of the revolutionaries in Latin America, Nicaragua, these are people who have pursued resistance through violence, and inevitably, and in all cases, it leads to the creation of a violent society. So whatever other rationales come into play, it doesn't fit with our authentically indigenous value system. Okay? And again, reminding people, I'm simplifying here. The book is, I think, about 400 pages trying to explain all the subtleties involved in this argument here. So nobody here in North America, in public anyway, gets up and say that we should be following the path of violent armed revolution, except Ward Churchill. But as I understand, he doesn't practice what he preaches, but he's preaching it. So it's a very marginal perspective, so I don't spend too much time on that. Right? One that I do spend a lot of time in the book on is economic development. Because economic development is the new mantra for government and for our indigenous political leaders in trying to confront this problem. We're colonized. And how do they define colonization? They define it in this path here, in this whole framework of understanding, as a material problem. Economic deprivation, poverty, lack of adequate housing, water and sewer, no opportunities, no jobs, leading to all of the problems that manifest themselves in social problems and so forth. There's a very well-developed discourse on this. And you can look all over the government websites, and most of academic literature that's written on the problem of indigenous peoples in the state today is oriented towards this path. But I would argue, and I do argue, that the same logic that holds the violent revolutionary to a violent future holds the economic development advocate to a capitalist future. And it only makes sense if you're going to confront the problem of colonialism by using arguments of economic development, which are basically arguments for the capitalization of indigenous society and the integration of indigenous peoples into a market economy, a wage economy, and the development of wealth in communities and the integration into a larger economic system. Even if you're successful, which is asking a lot these days because hardly any of these enterprises are actually successful even in their own terms, Even if you are successful, what do you get? You get capitalists. So with the armed revolutionary, you get a totalitarian. With the economic development advocate, you get a capitalist. Is that what we and our ancestors set out to achieve in advancing a struggle for indigenous justice? I would argue no. And the classic example of the faults of this process are in the casino, so-called casino tribes in the United States. I mean, we have it in our own communities today in the Iroquoian world, where we have a bright shining example of capitalistic success. There's a lot of them. I mean, I guess the most well-known one would be the Oneidas and Ray Halbreeder, and that's someone that I interviewed for my book because I was interested in engaging people on their ideas, engaging people and understanding the rationales and what it is that motivated their taking these paths. And I didn't want to overly simplify and demonize anyone, so I wanted to honestly understand and engage these people. And the rhetoric is powerful and the rationality is there, but I don't think that the groundedness and the rootedness in the understandings that come from our teachings and our culture and our value system and our spirituality is there, which allows someone to look at the problem as a material problem and end up as a capitalist and still think that they're doing good and the best for their people as could be done. So we have these paths, the violent path, the path of capitalism. And then there's another one, I believe, that is, in fact, the one that is characterized in most progressive circles in Canada and the United States, to a larger extent in Canada, and the Commonwealth countries, Australia, New Zealand, and so forth, in very progressive terms, and in fact, in ways that would lead you to believe that this is the most just path, or the only path to justice for Indigenous peoples, which is the path of law, which is the path of constitutional rights, the path of confronting colonialism through the reconfiguration of the state and the integration of Indigenous peoples into a multicultural society or into a just relationship in the context of Canada. And you can talk about whatever rhetoric that you want to talk about, but basically it's about legal transformation of the society to accommodate Indigenous existences. And here we have the bulk of Indigenous scholars work within this realm here. If you think about all the work that's been written in self-government, justification for self-government process, think about the work of someone who's a friend of mine, John Burroughs, who does legal theory and talks about re-indigenizing or indigenizing law within Canada and so forth. Again, it's rationalized, it's well thought, it's laid out, and it's structured to be a pathway from colonization to decolonization. And it's a little harder to criticize this one because it's not violent, it's not crass materialism. It comes in the guise of wanting to elevate existence and talks about reconciliation and all these types of good things. But think about it seriously and what it means. And again, I would argue that the means and the ends consistency is there. The armed revolutionary becoming the totalitarian, the economic development person becoming a capitalist, while the legal activist in the end becomes a citizen, because the only carrier of rights within the constitutional framework of a country is a citizen of that country. And here's where it's hard to criticize, because how many non-Indigenous people would think that it's a bad thing to be a citizen of Canada? In fact, when I go talk in Toronto or Vancouver, and most people fought like hell to get to Canada, and are happy to be here, to suggest that citizenship is in the same category as being a crass materialist and a totalitarian for Indigenous people, I get looks of disbelief or scorn. You know, how could you want to reject citizenship as the end object of your struggle when citizenship gives you so much? And now it even gives you something called Aboriginal rights. And it gives you all of the benefits of this society plus, citizens plus. Has been well elaborated by scholars within Canada. Well, the argument against that is that that is not what our ancestors, and that is not what our teachings, and that is not what our spirituality and our laws and our ways of being allow. It doesn't promote citizenship within Canada. We have a fully elaborated vision of our relationship to Canada that is antithetical to what people would understand as citizenship or being Aboriginal within Canada. So most of my book is focused on this third path, because I think the others are real easy to deconstruct and delegitimate. The third one, though, it is what Native politics is about in its most progressive form, which makes it very difficult to counter, because so many of our own people are now advocates and participants in the rationalization and the conduct of this policy of what I label in the book Aboriginalism. Because, first of all, I hate the word Aboriginal. Secondly, I think it is an ideology that's developing. It's an ideology of being Indigenous, of being Ongwehunwe, framed totally within the context of the colonial culture, which is going to transform itself to allow the existence or to tolerate the existence of an Indigenous person or Indigenous community to the extent that it doesn't threaten the pre-existing institutions, values, cultural patterns, and social relationships in that society. So basically, it's opening up a little bit of space to capture that indigeneity without fundamentally taking the lessons that culture brings to that society and using it to transform the society for the better. So it's a form of capture and it's a form of containment. And I think the whole process of Aboriginal law and the development of the notion of Aboriginal rights and title in Canada is reflective of that. People came from a very rooted existence in a lot of cases to challenge the practices that were happening in Canada in regard to land dispossession, self-government, or other more fundamental forms of abuse against people. And they kind of poured their culture and their Indigenous soul into the process. The classic example of this is the Delgamuukw case with the Wet'suwet'en and the Gik'san peoples in northern British Columbia. And I happen to know more about this because my wife is Wet'suwet'en and I was involved with them for a little bit politically. And I know how sincere these people were in pouring out all of their knowledge, trusting that the Canadian state and the Canadian system would respect the power of that and would respect the need to come to a coexistence and to accommodate that existence in the creation of a new idea of what Canada was.